Okay, we continue with the comprehensive review of the IFRS for SME.
Is this the last time? Is this the last time?
Probably the last but one. I suggest we start with agenda paper 8A. At the April meeting, the ISB considered whether to make changes to the IFRS for SMEs for six new and revised IFRSs. The staff would now like the ISB to consider the other new and revised IFRS. These are listed in paragraph 7 of agenda paper 8A. In this paper, the staff are recommending amending the IFRS for SMEs for four of the new or revised IFRS, and also for six annual improvements. These are listed in paragraph 12 and paragraph 16. Obviously, during drafting, the staff will need to consider how best to tailor them for SMEs. We've selected these new and revised IFRS and also the annual improvements because we believe they clarify the existing requirements and in most cases also provide a simplification. But the transactions that they cover are just as likely to occur for SMEs as publicly accountable entities, and also that they generally result in relatively minor changes, so they're consistent with the need for stability during the initial comprehensive review. So the question for the ISB is firstly, does the ISB agree to incorporate the four new or revised IFRS listed in paragraph 12 during this comprehensive review?
Yes. Stephen?
I don't disagree. But 12A and this the foreign currency rights issue thing, how is including that consistent with paragraph 9C, changes under new and revised IFRS should not be incorporated if they only expect to have a limited practical impact?
Well, we think, I mean, you could argue that it has a limited impact, but it would just be a modifying the definition, and we think that it does address an issue that's just as likely for the SMEs as publicly accountable entities.
I agree with paragraph 12, but I just disagree with paragraph 9. And I disagree with 9C. And I disagree with 9E. I think changes should be considered against whether we do a change. What you say in 9E about user needs and cost benefit, that should guide how we incorporate something, not whether we should incorporate something. Because otherwise, we run the risk of a whole series of changes to the main IFRS never being even considered for IFRS for SMEs, and then the two standards just continually diverge. Mm-hmm. So I know you're not asking about paragraph 9, but I thought I'd make the point.
Any other comments? Do we agree with the staff recommendation?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you also agree there is just a paragraph about how we plan to amend IFRIC 19? For cost-benefit reasons, the staff are suggesting an undue cost or effort exemption should be included to provide relief from fair value measurement of the equity instruments. This is a link to get a little bit to issue 9 in agenda paper 8B. So you might want to come back and consider it then.
Where are you referring to?
It's actually paragraph 14 of agenda paper 8A. It's something I could consider during drafting. It's just a link to an issue we're discussing later as well.
If they're not measured at fair value, then how are they measured?
Well, I think I've got a copy of 19 here, but it says that they have to be measured at fair value and if it can be measured reliably. And then if not, I think it's at the fair value of the financial liability. But the only change we'd be proposing to what's in IFRIC 19 is IFRIC 19 says when equity instruments issued to a creditor to extinguish all or part of a financial liability recognised initially, an entity shall measure them at the fair value of the equity instruments issued unless that fair value cannot be reliably measured. And we're just suggesting putting without undue cost or effort on the end of that.
Okay. Agreed?
Yes.
So does the ISB agree not to incorporate the other new and revised IFRS, paragraph 15?
Philippe?
I generally agree. I have a question on one of the, which is on the list. It's paragraph E, bottom of page 7, relates to OCI. We, full IFRS, we have decided to bring more clarity to the components of OCI, distinguishing what is recyclable, reclassifiable, and what is not. I think the benefit of transparency on OCI should also be available to the readers of IFRS for SMEs financial statements. And the argument that the staff put forward for not making the amendment is that there are only three types of OCI. It's simple. But among those three types, some will reclassify, some will not, I suppose, unless I'm wrong. So making the amendment to keep the OCI presentation similar for SMEs as it is for other companies would not be that onerous, I think, for SMEs, and could bring some benefits for the users at a very, very limited cost for the SMEs in terms of complexity and implementation. So I think if you look at the cost-benefit test, that one would qualify for being made as an amendment, I believe. For the rest, I'm fine.
How would you propose to deal with future additions to OCI that may be triggered by changes in IFRS? Would we, if they started to accumulate from 3 to 5 to 7 items?
I believe the more we have, the more we need to make this distinction.
Exactly. So I think Philippe makes a very good point.
I mean, in the SME case, it would be that the equivalent of cash flow hedges would be ones that are recycled, and the other two ones that wouldn't.
Right.
So that would be the.
And I think there's nothing in this current round of changes that would introduce new OCI items.
No.
So, I mean, there'd probably be a question to Pat's question, something that we would answer if we ever got to that place.
But what about the current situation? Don't you think that to bring some clarity in terms of what is reclassified or not is beneficial today, and that the cost of doing that for an SME is very, very small?
I certainly would feel pretty even on this. I don't really mind one or the other, so I don't think it's a particularly big difference to make that change.
May go?
I fully agree with Philippe. You know, I think these items, if we follow Philippe's suggestions, will increase usefulness, you know, but I don't think it will increase a lot of cost because just, you know, split into two parts, you know, that's all. It will be useful.
So let's see who agrees with not putting in amendments H through D, but to do include the presentation of items through OCI.
Still missing that. That's 13.
15?
Okay.
Would that also include, because that was the main change by the amendment, but it also made some wording changes to IS1, such as changing things like the statement of comprehensive income to the statement of profit or loss of comprehensive income. Would people want those kind of changes to go through as well? Or would you do specifically the main key change?
I think they should go through as well, because if we don't do this, as I say, they just diverge. It'll just be the little bits each time, but the more we say, oh, it's just a small change, let's not bother, the more we end up with just two completely different standards.
I mean, the counter-argument to that is that we make the SME standard more and more complicated and aim is to keep it simple.
So, well, wording changes doesn't make it complicated. It just ensures that the language and the style is aligned with full IFRS, which is how it started.
Well, there's a non-mandatory wording, which will take some people out of context. A lot of people are used to talking about balance sheet and income statement and things like that, and we want to introduce wording which is not common to people, and I think that is a mistake.
Well, that might have been a mistake for the full IFRS.
It was, and I objected to that at the time.
But we've done it, so.
I think you could argue that there's a reason for this difference for SMEs, and it's mainly because of the type of people who apply it and the sort of financial reports they're used to preparing. And I can understand your point, but I don't think this is a major issue.
I mean, I'm fine. If there's a conscious reason to have a difference in the IFRS for SMEs, so when it was first developed, had that wording been a full IFRS, and we'd have deliberately changed the wording for IFRS for SMEs, then that's fine. But just to automatically say, oh, it's just a small change, let's not bother including it. I think we need to evaluate each one and, as far as possible, keep them aligned.
But I think another reason is we want to limit the changes in the SME standard as much as we can. And so this one feels to me like kind of doing it for the sake of doing it.
It's not mandatory. The rules are not mandatory. So.
I don't see a lot of support for Stephen's suggestion. No? We agree with the staff recommendation.
And does the IFB also agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 16 for which annual improvements to incorporate?
Michelle, what paragraph are you reading from?
16.
Paragraph 16.
The staff reasoning is in the appendix.
Right, okay.
Agreed?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Next paper.
The ISB discussed all of the issues addressed by individual questions in the request for information at the March and April meeting. The request for information also asked an open question to encourage respondents to raise their own issues, and all the additional issues raised by respondents have been included in agenda papers 8B and 8C. In selecting issues for the paper, the staff have included all issues raised by more than two comment letters, regardless of the issue that was raised. And we've also used judgment to include other issues, for example, maybe due to their nature, or maybe they're raised by a jurisdiction from which we only had one comment letter. Now, we've used this criterion preparing the agenda papers so that the ISB can see the most common and the key issues. However, for many of these issues, the staff are not proposing changes. For example, some of these issues were discussed at length when the IFRS for SMEs was initially issued. Therefore, we split the issues between two papers. Agenda 8B contains those for which we're proposing changes, and 8C contains those issues for which we're not. So if we start with agenda paper 8B. The first issue is, should more guidance be provided on interpretation of undue cost or effort? That's used in several sections of the IFRS for SMEs. The question for the ISB is, does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation to incorporate the SME implementation group Q&A with a modification that an entity considers its expected user group when making the assessment, but that no further guidance should be provided?
Michelle, I thought, I'm in agreement with the recommendation, but I thought the language in the second part of paragraph B, C, 3, basis for conclusions, which appears in the paper in paragraph 7. I thought that was actually quite helpful, and to bring that forward, I think, provides better context around which we're providing this relief, this undue cost or effort relief. It says that assessing whether cost or effort is undue would have to make an assessment of how important the information is to users. And if the information that the user needs is not provided, that they may have to incur additional costs to obtain it. So putting that in the basis, I think, is not giving it as much, I think, attention as it needs to actually clarify really what we mean by undue cost or effort.
Okay.
Mary?
Also, support the the basic staff recommendation about not incorporating additional guidance. One comment and one question. The comment is, I think it would be helpful to emphasize more that this is a consideration, you know, an assessment that has to be made at least at each reporting date, rather than you make it once for the item at the, you know, in the initial recognition and measurement, and then don't have to revisit it, because some of the comments and some of the submissions that were quoted implied that there had been a conclusion that it would cost too much to hire a valuer, so we're not doing it. And my understanding is this is something that should be reassessed on the basis of circumstances at each reporting date. And I think it is in the Q&A, but maybe needs to be punched up. Second is, it wasn't clear, and I didn't have a chance to check, whether an entity, in respect to your question about disclosure, I agree that you should not have to disclose the reasoning to reach that conclusion, but do you have to disclose that undue cost and effort was invoked, and therefore you are not measuring?
I don't think there is, no. There isn't a specific requirement to disclose that.
As it could change the measurement basis, I would imagine that would be a reasonably important disclosure to flag up for people, that somebody has used undue cost and effort to, let's say, not hire a valuer and measure at fair value.
Yeah, I think with something like for biological assets, say, where you've fair value, unless it's undue cost or effort, you are required to split between what's that fair value and what isn't the fair mm-hmm. value. So even though you're not stating you're using it, it's kind of evident that because mm-hmm. you've got the split on the balance sheet.
If you could consider that as you're looking at the drafting, I think that would be helpful.
With these drafting suggestions, do we agree?
Yes. Yes.
Do we need to take a vote or just?
No, there was no disagreement. So.
Okay.
Are you meeting with 1A and 1B at the same time?
The SME implementation group suggested entities applying the undue cost or effort exemption should be required to disclose their reasons for doing so. The staff don't agree with requiring this disclosure. So question 1B is, does the ISB agree entities should not be required to disclose their reasons for applying any of the undue cost or effort exemptions?
But then you will consider the MERIS recommendation. So there will be a matter of drafting, considering what's Mary suggested. Not the reasoning, but explicitly that it was not considered because of the undue cost or effort.
Yeah.
What was the conclusion on the 1B drafting? Because I
have... I think I jumped the gun when I offered my comment.
Exactly. So,
yeah. I personally feel that the... Because we don't define what undue cost and benefit is, and so I think they should disclose it that they have not applied. Like in a business combination, for example.
Yeah, that's what
Mary suggested. No, I'm just saying that I agree with her, I just want to say that I don't agree. It's not a blanket yes. I just want to make sure that I stand opposed to that view, because if they are going to use it and we don't define it and it's left to the people's decision, so there's consistency is not there, then that needs to be supplemented with a disclosure. Like in a business combination, you say subsequently, intangibles need not be broken out from goodwill if you don't believe that it's undue cost and effort. One is one way. Of course, in SMEs, you amortize goodwill, so life becomes a little bit easier. But still, I think you need to mention that you because of different lives.
Mm-hmm. I just worry we're dealing with non-public accountable entities here, and we're trying to keep it simple, and we're trying to keep it brief, and I'd be very cautious about adding extra disclosures.
Yeah, but it's just one sentence. For due to undue cost and disclosure, undue cost, the management has decided not to break the intangible.
This is one where I agree with Ian.
if you want to kiss up to him. I personally believe that otherwise anybody looking at those financials don't get an idea of why it is done and why it is not done.
But they won't get an idea of why it's done from your suggestion. I mean, I take the point. And if this was a full IFRS, I'd be fully on side. But we've got to keep stepping back.
If it's full IFRS, you're not following IFRS. There is no undue cost there. It's impractical. It's a very high threshold under new IAS 8.
What I'm saying is if these circumstances obtained for IFRS.
Yeah, but having adding a sentence is not a cost to anyone, Ian. And but I think it brings a lot of judgment. Look at the conditions under 14A, B, and C. We don't even know how to do this. We don't want to define it.
PK, can I just understand what you're saying though? Because are you saying that they should disclose why they did it, or simply that they've done it? So you'd say
no, if they have not done it due to undue cost, in the management's opinion, due to undue cost, they have not broken the goodwill in business combinations once in a lifetime.
They're not explaining the why.
No. Do you want them to say they have, or do you want them to explain why they have not?
No. Just that they have not.
I don't need to do it for them. They have not.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we all agree.
Except me.
No, except Ian. And of course, you convert Kisab.
It's not even bad vinegar. It's not even comply. Explain. It is.
And so I don't even think it's very useful, quite frankly.
Of course not.
I mean.
Me too. And if you add the guidance in paragraph BC3, which elevates the judgment that has to be reached to come to that, I think.
Trust me.
It's more comply or signal.
Yes.
Signal that you do.
I think your caution is right, and I think if we already have other presentation or disclosure requirements that address it, let's say. Splitting out those biological assets that have not been measured at fair value, that implicitly covers that. But I think it's worth looking at as we go through the places where undue cost and effort is allowed, because I would want to know if something that I expect, if I'm familiar at all with the SME standard and I expect that this is measured at fair value and there's just a value there, I want to know whether that is fair value or a carryover of historical cost, because management has concluded that fair value is undue cost and effort. And if there's no flag that that's on another basis than what I would expect from the standard, I think I'd want to know. But if we've got that in terms of requiring split presentation places, I agree with you, no need to add a sentence that says, note that the amounts measured at cost have not been measured at fair value due to undue cost and effort.
So, Michelle, the situation is we do have that split presentation.
Well, I think we put about six places where it's used, and for about three or four, it's clear, but maybe the other two would be useful having that clarification because it's more difficult to see.
Good. Sorry, Ian.
Okay.
Okay, issue two. Is regarding using uniform reporting dates for consolidation purposes. The issue raised in the comment letters say that the impracticable is too high a hurdle and there should be further relief from the requirement to use uniform reporting dates, and also that additional guidance should be provided on the necessary adjustments if uniform reporting dates are not used. And does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation to add guidance on making adjustments if different reporting dates are used, but not to relax the impracticable criteria?
Okay, can you agree?
Agree.
Agree.
Okay. Agreed?
I have only one question.
Amado?
Sorry. So you are suggesting 9.16 using the most recent financial statement. So, such could be a stupid question. If the most recent is 2 years late?
Mm-hmm. I've taken the wording from full IFRS. I've been looking at it.
So the question is still valid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would be okay. So we have a subsidiary in a country that is under stress, 3 years. Mm-hmm. Old, and I'm using this one because I don't have with no adjustment anything else.
Actually, in full IFRS, we do have a requirement that can't be a difference greater than 3 months.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we don't actually have that. We allow more flexibility.
The flexibility here might be, I would suggest, most recent at least 1 year or so.
Yeah. Just to Mara's point, this does require that you adjust for anything right. that happens subsequent. Yeah. And also we've got the impracticable. So it suggests that in order to get past the impracticable, it's not that you're using the older set of financial, or the most recent set of financial statements produced, it's using the most the information you can get. So I'm not sure if the two of those...
I'm reading this and translating to Portuguese. Most recent could be 10 years old. If I prove to you that this is the most recent I have.
So, what can you do? What else can you
but
do?
But if you
don't
trust...
You don't I'm
just asking.
It might suggest you don't have control if you can't get financial statements for 10 years.
If it is impracticable, what do you do?
Exactly. If you conclude that you should consolidate, use what you have and make adjustment as much as you can.
Of course, this never happens in Brazil.
Yeah.
Okay. We agree?
Without any changes, exactly the way it works.
Yep.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to issue 3 in paragraph 24. Two problems have been raised regarding a literal reading of the criteria for a basic debt instrument in paragraph 11.9. That's they say most loan covenants will result in bank loans failing to meet the criteria in paragraph 11.9c. And those in a foreign currency will fail the criteria in paragraph 11.9a. Does the ISB agree to amend 11.9 as recommended to correct unintended consequences of the current wording?
Yep, agreed.
Agreed.
Issue 4, the issue raised is recognising all intangibles of the inquiry in a business combination is too complex for SMEs and is costly to use valuation experts. Currently, the IFRS for SMEs requires intangibles to be recognised separately if their fair value can be measured reliably. Does the ISB agree to amend paragraphs 18.8 and 19.15 to add an undue cost or effort exemption to the requirement to recognise intangibles separately in a business combination?
Yes.
We go.
Minor question. Paragraph 36, you know, the paragraph you propose to change, and I'm a little bit unclear which hurdle would be high. You know, C, you say in the case of a contingent liability, the fair value can be measured reliably. And the next one, in the case of intangible assets, its fair value can be measured reliably without undue cost or effort. Which one will be high hurdle?
The C would be the high hurdle. I think in the case that it's almost saying that with a contingent liability, you've got to attempt to measure the fair value, whether with the intangible asset, if it's going to result in, if it's going to be too costly, you wouldn't need to attempt it.
So in terms of in the contingent liability,
you have to. You have to do very well.
No, I think, you know, the hurdle will be lower. You say the hurdle will be lower or higher?
But it would be lower for D.
Yeah.
Higher for C.
Higher for C.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So lower, to me, you know, it possibly you might be required to measure at fair value for B or for C than D. All right?
Yeah, we're not changing the requirements for contingent liability. It would just be for intangibles that we're lowering the hurdle.
So there's no change to C, only to D.
Okay.
Philippe?
I'm a little bit like Wigo. I'm wondering whether we're not really putting the threshold much lower now, and maybe lower than we intend. The principle is that you should identify and measure the fair value of intangibles unless you can't. And now we seem to reverse it to say you do it if you can. It seems my understanding of the wording is that we are quite changing the emphasis to do it if you can without spending too much money.
Yeah.
Which really negating the principle, I think. So I would rather try to keep the principle strong that you should normally do it unless you have undue cost or effort. But now we are quite changing the focus. Maybe it's my perception of drafting. It's maybe drafting, but I really see a big change in a big shift in the emphasis.
So, Philippe, you're saying that if you can't do reliably, you don't do. Is your
if you can't do reliably, you never do. Never. Even in reference. Now we say you do it only if you can do it reliably and without cost of effort, which is, in most people we say, oh, yes, I could do it, but it's going to cost me some money, so I don't do it anyway, which is what we're encouraging to do. So I think we should be somewhere in between.
So how do you suggest?
It's drafting, so it's not my expertise in drafting. But I think I see a perception of a big shift in the emphasis from do it unless to now do it if you wish, if you can.
Mm. Yeah, just on continuing the question. Intangible assets, sometimes when you use fair value, maybe the fair value might be lower. Like in contingent liability, you know, we must recognize that the decrease in fair value in intangible assets. So if we just apply some kind of prudence concept here in C and D, then I guess we shouldn't assume that we are just assuming increase in fair value of intangible assets if we apply a fair value. So I'm just saying, you know, apply this, no? The threshold is a difference between the contingent liability and the intangible assets.
So here, nothing to do with positive or negative. No. It's neutral.
Yeah, it's neutral.
It's neutral here. Yeah. You want to put some kind of prudent idea inside.
Yes.
But this is just saying, the same as you do with full IFRS, when you have an acquisition, you divide the intangibles up. And so it's exactly the same as full IFRS, except it says where you can't reliably measure, it used to say, then you don't. Or now in D, and this is what Philippe's worried about, if it's going to be too difficult. Actually, too costly. I have a bit of sympathy for too costly because dividing up the intangibles and valuing them can be quite a difficult and costly exercise.
And it's too costly in the context of undue cost and effort, as we explained it previously, which is you need to look to what your users require and all those sorts of additional parameters. Yeah. So it's not a pure free choice. There's a lot of things that you have to think about before you contribute.
And we need to see the wording altogether, given what we said before.
It does feel to me like it's more about the drafting than about...
Just worried of not putting the threshold too low so that people can say, well, I don't do
I'm not too concerned about this for the following reason. In most instances, when you make an acquisition and you're going to recognize an intangible asset, you're doing so not for financial reporting purposes, but you're doing for tax purposes because you're going to get a deduction. So if you can do it for tax purposes because it's going to produce a tax deduction, the issue of undue cost and effort completely goes away. So I would generally not be concerned about them not being able to do this. Highly unlikely that they're going to actually want to be seeking and looking to book these things if they're not getting tax benefits.
The U.S., you can. In many jurisdictions, you don't get a tax benefit on an acquisition.
If they don't, then they probably won't be going to
the effort of identifying.
Michelle, in the light of our previous discussion, I go with it, but I wrote when I read the paper, but might be a code for not looking too hard. That's what it is boiling down to. If I have an intangible which has a useful life of 12 years, I will make sure it happens because goodwill is amortized over 10 years. So I can stretch this longer. So it gives you perverse incentives to do it when if you believe intangible life is greater than 10 years, and if it's less than 10 years, you don't look too hard because everything is done. So I think that's incentive what we are giving them. That's why I was saying that when you do this, disclose it, so that at least there is some rigor to it. So that's one of the reasons. Actually, this question prompted me to go back and look at the undue cost.
Okay. I think we agree.
Issue 5 starts at paragraph 38. IFRS versus MEES does not have exemptions for defined benefit obligations and deferred taxes on the allocation of the cost of a business combination. So the issue raised in the comment letters is that without this, SMEs are obliged to determine pure fair value. At the SME implementation group, several members told us that although the current wording is unclear, they believe in practice SMEs are already measuring them in accordance with Section 28 and Section 29 rather than trying to determine the pure fair value. But nevertheless, staff recommend revising the wording to correct unintended consequences. So does the ISB agree to amend paragraph 19.14 as recommended by the staff?
I see agreement around the table.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, issue 6 starts paragraph 44, and it's two issues regarding common control exemptions. The first question for the ISB is, firstly, does the ISB agree to amend paragraph 22.8, as recommended in paragraph 47 by the staff, to add an exemption from fair value measurement for equity instruments issued as part of a business combination under common control?
Yes, yes, we agree.
Does the ISB agree to add paragraph 22.19, as recommended in paragraph 49, to add a scope exemption similar to IFRIC 17, the distribution of non-cash assets ultimately controlled by the same party before and after distribution?
We agree with that as well.
Yes. Sure, very simple question. I agree with the proposals, but I think you will explain in the basis for those transactions and the common controls, you will still have to account for some ways. Rather than, you know, as the members suggest, you have no room to give people. I understand. Am I understanding right?
I don't know what you mean, sorry. Do you mean to put requirements in for the common control?
No. I agree with the proposal. But we'll explain just like the big book. You know, even though we not touch the business combination and the common control, mm-hmm. and also not specific the methodologies, but you can use some way. Am I right?
So we leave it. IFRS for SMEs leaves it open to choose.
Yes, one
yes,
of the
yes,
ways. Yes, yes, yes.
So you could, by analogy, apply the same requirements.
Yes, yes.
There's nothing to stop you doing it.
Yeah. So I think you should explain the basis. You know.
Okay. Mary?
Agree with the staff recommendation, but I think because in these two areas we are knowingly creating a range of accounting, we should consider whether we should add a disclosure requirement that says, describe how you've measured these transactions. Because before there was only one way, you had to do it at fair value. And now we're saying maybe fair value or maybe some other basis.
I think that would be required under Section 10, but I'll have to check if you develop an accounting policy. But I will check.
And if it is covered under another section, or we won't duplicate it.
No, don't have to duplicate it, right.
Okay, issue 7 starts at paragraph 50. And the issue that was raised is the related party definition in Section 33 is based on the 2008 exposure draft, because the IFRS for SMEs was finalised before IAS 24 was updated in 2009, and therefore it, in particular, it refers to an undefined term, significant voting power. Does ISB agree that the related party definition in Section 33 should be revised to be consistent with IAS 24, and also add a definition of close family member based on the definition in IAS 24?
No. Nobody wants to be inconsistent. No.
Issue 8 starts on paragraph 56, and that's on extractive activities. The issue raised is more guidance is required for extractive activities, and that the current requirements are confusing because they're relatively thin. The first question 8A is, does the ISB agree to amend paragraph 34.11 as recommended by the staff in paragraph 62?
Perhaps, Michelle, you could explain the issue for me a little bit more, because this change seems to me to be a big change, and I'm not sure I grasp all the implications, because we don't have any guidance on extractive industry, so it was very confusing for me.
I think what in the standard at the moment, what the requirement is to look to sections 17 and 18, and then section 17, 18 scope it out. so that SMEs are currently left with looking to Section 10 to develop their own accounting policy. I think that's how, if you read it, that's what you would come to. So there is a flexibility there to either apply Section 17 and 18 on property, plant, and equipment and intangibles, or look back to full IFRS and apply IFRS 6, say. But because it's a bit written in a bit of a confusing way to reference them into a standard and then to reference them out, basically what we're putting more guidance in to sort of clarify that that's what you can do.
So it's not changing what they can do, it's just making it simpler to understand what they can do.
Yeah.
Okay, we agree.
Right. Issue 9 is the last issue in the agenda paper, and this is actually one raised by members of the SME implementation group on unlisted equity instruments. A few SME implementation group members noted that requirements to measure unlisted equity instruments at fair value is causing problems. In practice, this means entities need to try and determine fair value if they can, because the current requirement is if fair value can be measured reliably, and they have to do this on an annual basis regardless of the cost. So does the ISB agree to amend, should be paragraph 11.14 and 12.8, as recommended in paragraph 69, to add an undue cost or effort exemption from the measurement of equity instruments?
Doug?
Yes, I agree with the staff recommendation, but I think we need to discuss the issue about objectivity here in the basis or not, or somewhere. Perhaps for the valuation of unlisted equity instruments, issue like subjectivity versus objectivity is very important. Suppose if you estimate your business, value of your business, then some subjectivity could be allowed. But when you measure equity instruments, that is the other person's business. Therefore, the objectivity is really important. Whether or not we could obtain the objective evidence is really important issue. So I do not disagree your proposal, and I appreciate that, and that is very important to add the undue cost. That is fine, but in your BC or somewhere, if you could provide some discussion about the subjectivity versus objectivity, and that means if you cannot obtain the objective evidence which support the value of the equity instruments.
No further comments?
Only small amendment. If otherwise, I think the entity has to recognize any impairment, but when impairment you have also to measure the fair value, and isn't it a little bit inconsistent if you have this undue cost and effort relief from fair value measure, but then you say, okay, if you cannot do that because it is too many costs, but then go to cost with impairment, but with impairment you have also to do fair value, otherwise you cannot. And isn't it a little bit illogical?
It is, but impairment you don't do it every year. Whereas on the equity instruments, you have to do it every year or whenever you produce financial statements. There are times when you don't need to do impairment because you feel that the value is much better than higher than your cost.
That triggers.
Yeah.
The triggering point. How often does it trigger?
I agree with the when we develop new 9, one of the major controversies over whether we should keep cost exemption, and some board members say no, because, you know, if you require costs, we still have to do impairment. You know, no difference from fair value measurement, but I think PK is right. You know, if you require fair value at all, you have to do every times. But if you have cost exemptions, you know, impairment, it will be not after do every day, every time.
Okay, I think we agree with this proposal as well.
So moving on to paper AC.
Do we want to finish off or do we want a short break?
No, we'll finish it up. It's on the exception basis.
Go quick.
Yeah.
It's a whole paper, I think, just goes at once.
Agenda paper 8C contains the additional issues raised by respondents for which the staff have not proposed any changes. Therefore, the staff suggests that the ISB only needs to discuss those issues for which any ISB members have objections to the staff recommendation or have any queries. So do any ISB members have objections to issues in Agenda Paper 8C that they'd like to raise and discuss?
I would not say objection, but I want to bring to your notice something. This is the issue A7, which I understand Amy came and talked to you a few hours ago. The suggestion that you have for the disclosures for the subsidiaries can imply there are three levels now. There's full IFRS, there's IFRS for subsidiaries with reduced disclosure, and there is SME. And the disclosure feedback summary that we are soon to publish, when is it, Alan? Tomorrow, day after, next week? Alan is not listening. This week, right? The disclosure feedback?
Yep.
And in that disclosure feedback, we said we are definitely not trying to do that because we don't want to create three layers. Mm-hmm. And here you suggest that that the board should take it up. I want to be very consistent with the disclosure feedback, and I agree with that. We cannot create three layers here.
Yeah.
So I recommend you to modify that or make sure that we don't take it up as a separate project.
Okay.
Any other comments?
Well, I disagree. I think we should.
I agree. I also think we should.
Then you need to give him comments about the disclosure feedback, which is going to be published, which says that, and I agree with that.
Which paragraph are you referring to?
Paragraph 40.
8C40.
I think there's a case for subsidiaries of listed companies having the recognition and measurement of full IFRS and the disclosure of IFRS revenues.
I wouldn't agree with that. That's
Well, I think there is a case to be made. I'm not saying that.
Then we need to change the disclosure feedback. And if that is, if somebody wants to raise that, and that's something subject to debate.
I don't think you need to change the disclosure feedback statement. That just be something you do general review, because I think what Steve's saying is that you look at IAS 27 and it's got, you're hooked into, for the separate financial statements, you have to meet all the requirements and then point to the consolidated financial statements to which they relate. There's nothing that says you've got the separate financial statements and it has a slightly reduced disclosure and then point to the ones. I think that's
what
you're
saying. But when do you publish the subsidiary? When do you publish subsidiary financial statements?
Well, so Steve, are you saying the subsidiary ones was at the parent only?
I'm saying this is something the board should discuss.
I agree.
I'm not saying that I necessarily have the answer to what it should be.
That's fair.
It's something that we often hear.
So are we creating...
Dismiss it out of hand.
No, all I'm trying to say is that are we creating three layers? Yeah. And that's what your feedback, somebody says, we don't want to create three layers of the thing.
No, the layers in the disclosure feedback are about... listed entities that are mid-caps, in other words, the smaller listed entities. This is a different class of entities. When do you
publish
wholly owned subsidiaries of companies?
When do you need to publish those financial statements for subsidiaries on a standard basis?
It depends on each country. In Sweden, it's end of July.
It's a statutory requirement within the EU.
UK, you have to.
Yeah. And are those under IFRS?
Yes, and they have to do full
under
IFRS.
Under UK, I don't think it's IFRS yet. Statutory financial statements.
Well, they don't have to, but many choose because they have
choose to. It's a choice. I think that's fine, but all I'm trying to say is that be consistent, be clarifying what you're talking at in that. Agreed that the feedback summary talks about smaller public companies. I don't know the scope of this, where it will stop, because I'm very worried about the scope creep and having another layer of IFRSs. That's all I'm trying to say.
Don't worry too much. The project not started yet.
No, I don't even want to. I'll be gone.
I just had a question. Michelle, you're recommending in paragraphs 53 through 6 that the guidance in section 23 of the IFRS for SMEs, which deals with accounting for barter transactions, would still benefit from the guidance in current literature. We're about to issue a new standard dealing with revenue recognition, which would eliminate and supersede SIC 31. So would that affect the IFRS for SMEs, even though they may not adopt that new standard?
Well, I'm proposing not to incorporate SIC 31. We'll just stay what we have at the moment. So obviously when the new standard is issued, then we would consider that at the time.
And it doesn't become mandatory for 3 years anyway, and that's heading into your next review then anyway.
So. Yeah.
So you're saying that you have guidance on barter transactions in the IFRS for SMEs?
We have requirements as 23.6 and 23.7.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have an extra simplification in 23.7C, where we say the fair value of neither the asset received nor the asset given up can be measured, or the service received, service given up can be measured reliably, then the carrying amount is used.
Right, I was just reacting to the last sentence in 56. It said entities would be permitted to refer to SIC 31 for guidance, but if it's eliminated,
then
they wouldn't have it available.
Well, unless they can justify a similar practice under Section 10, they could look for further guidance as long as it's consistent with the requirements in the IFRS for SMEs. So.
Philippe? Well, to Steve's point, I think there is room for discussion about what you think we should be doing, but I think it's outside the scope of the SME standard. An SME standard is a standalone entity. An SME is a standalone entity. You can't rely on information to be provided by the parent in consolidation to help you understand the financial position. The subsidiary, we do, for instance, exempt from producing sub-consolidated statements, EBITDA subsidiaries, because there is the upper level at which you will find some information to help you understand. That isn't the case necessarily for an SME. So I think it's a different project for me. It's a good project, but it's a different one.
No, I agree. I was just reacting to what PK was
saying. I wouldn't agree till I'm on the board.
Okay. I think that brings us to the end.
Thank you
for our deliberations for today.